Welcome, Friends Journal readers, watchers, and listeners. My name is Trevor Johnson, and I'm the editorial fellow at Friends Journal. I'm here today with Lisa Graustein, who is saying hello from...
From New Haven, Connecticut.
New Haven, Connecticut today. Lisa is a member of Beacon Hill Friends meeting in Boston and is also a mother, high school teacher, a diversity trainer, and a former Young Friends coordinator for New England Yearly Meeting. She's also the author of Gender, Sexuality, and Our Bodies, one of the articles in the May issue on gender and sexuality. In that article, Lisa walks readers through various ways of thinking and talking about our bodies, gender, and sexuality. She also gives a survey of some Quakers and... She also gave a survey of some Quakers and presented their responses on how they talk about their bodies, gender, and sexuality. All of that was really wonderful. I really appreciated your article. So thanks, Lisa, for joining me. It's really nice to talk with you.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me to do this.
Of course, of course. So at the beginning of your article, you talk a little bit about having a six-year-old at home who's now seven. With the tools and frameworks that you have and use in this article, how do you see yourself using those as you raise your child?
In a lot of different ways. So my son was assigned male at birth. And, you know, I periodically ask him, I said, do you feel like a boy? What are the pronouns you want to use? We have the practice at the Rise of Meeting at my meeting of when we go around and introduce ourselves of about half of us share our pronouns. And so he's familiar with that practice. And so I make sure that I'm never assuming that his gender is static, that there's space for him to tell me if his gender is changing or if he wants to play around with it at all. He's pretty clear he's male and he likes those pronouns and that identity. When we read books, and I got this from my housemate, they'll often change the gender of characters because a lot of books are very male heavy. And so sometimes I'll change up the pronouns consistently throughout a book. Sometimes the character's pronouns will change throughout a book. I use gender-neutral pronouns. And pretty early on, he figured out that I was doing that. And he would say, you know, what does it really say in the book? And then that would lead into conversations about representation of gender, who gets to be strong and tough, who are the caregivers and the cleaners, you know, all those conversations that, that we should have with our kids. I try to raise him in a really body positive house. And so, you know, early on, he learned all the appropriate terms for his anatomy, for my anatomy, other anatomy he might encounter. I'm a sex ed teacher. He sat through workshops that I've done with roomful of teenagers around safe for sex. And so he has an awareness that our bodies are different. They show up differently. There's respectful language we can use to talk about them. And that when we're older, we get to share them in different ways with people. And that consent is part of that. Conversations are part of that. Health and safety are part of that. And then our collective household, we live with some other families, is diverse in its gender and sexual orientations. And so I'm also raising him in a kind of a bigger family and household where, you know, we all show up a little bit differently. We have different kinds of relationships. We have different bodies. We have different relationships with our bodies. And those are things that we can talk about and normalize and just kind of have be part of what we're doing. And I think another piece is training him in when he's meeting people and he's curious about some aspect of them, whether it's a physical aspect or a gendered aspect or, you know, who their family is and how their family is constructed, of how to ask those questions when he's curious in ways that are asking permission to ask the questions, are respectful, are polite. So, you know, in the same way that we teach kids to say please and thank you and figure out if they should take off their shoes at somebody's house. You know, you say, can I ask you what your pronouns are versus are you a man or a woman or things that, you know, young kids might ask. So asking those kinds of questions.
Yeah, that's great. So, you know, there is a lot of work that you've done around this topic, you know, in talking to you. So what is, I would love if you'd talk a little bit more specifically about, you know, what that work is and how specifically this piece that addresses so much grew out of that or informs that work now?
Yeah. So I started in two different places. The first was I was staffing the Young Friends program from New England Yearly Meeting, which every year since before I was a young friend in the program has had a retreat on was originally relationships and sexuality, then expanded to relationships, sexuality, and gender. And so was there part of a group of active adults really thinking critically about how do we bring our faith values and community into talking about a topic that's incredibly live and charged for teenagers mm-hmm. in a way that is accurate, safe, loving, informational, and, you know, is accessible to kids who are maybe not very active and just trying to think about it, and kids who are very sexually active and exploring a lot of different identities. And how do we hold all of that in a loving community? So that was one place where I sort of started to do that work. And then the other was, as a young public school teacher, in one school I was the only out teacher, and another I was one of only two out staff members. And so became the place that students and parents and other staff would go to when kids were coming out, when they needed information, when, you know, somebody said something in the hallway, they didn't know how to respond. And so a lot of the education I did for myself was figuring out how I could be that resource for schools and other people in a way that also was protective of myself and not constantly having to put my identity and my experience out there. And I'm mm-hmm. a pretty open person, so I'm happy to do a lot of that. But realizing pretty quickly on, I was going to be the person that a lot of people were going to come to in those schools to get information. And so I wanted to make sure that what I was giving to people was accurate, was respectful, and was inclusive of everybody. And so went to a lot of workshops, talked to a lot of folks, that kind of thing.
Yeah, there's a lot there of that, you know, kind of important work of like preparing before you start launching into that work. That's great.
And usually it was like the night before or after I got the question, or, you know, like things always are moving fast in a school.
Oh, of course. One of the really great pieces of your article, I thought, was there are 16 profiles of various folks and how they talk about their gender and their bodies and their sexuality, which I thought was, you know, allowed so many more voices to come to the table in this article and in this issue. I was really thankful for that. Where did you connect with those people, and what was the process for gathering those profiles?
So I wanted to present the model that I was presenting, but I didn't want it to just be my voice and my take on things. And I think in the first sentence of the article, one of the things I say is that there's no normal. And that the more I do sexuality education work, the more I talk about gender, the more I just meet people in the world. That's just true over and over again. There's no normal. Each of us has different experiences, different ways we understand stuff. And so if I was just presenting a model and talking about myself, that was going to be one narrow little slice. So I really wanted to expand it to get as many different voices and experiences in there. Not that I was going to cover the full spectrum of how humanity shows up, but just kind of give these tidbits of here's how differently we can think about ourselves. Here's where similarities we might not have expected across different identities can exist. And here's where all of us learning about each other can be enriching. I think so often when we talk about gender or sexuality, it's from a very cis or hetero space about how do we learn about the queer people. And I kind of wanted to bust that up a little bit and just say all of us should be considering these questions. All of us should be thinking about this. So to get those voices, and I was late to the submission deadline, so I had about a 4-day turnaround time. I'm on the FLGBTQC Friends for Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, Queer, Everybody Concerns listserv. So I sent out the questions to that listserv, which is a few hundred friends throughout the U.S. and Canada. Mm-hmm. I emailed my meeting community in Boston, which is pretty live and active. And then I probably emailed an additional, 50 or 100 friends of mine who are people who I know are committed to social justice and kind of expanding our collective ability to embrace everybody in whatever kind of work they do. And mostly I ended up having to use a lot fewer of the responses than I got just for space issues. And so tended to go with the people who got back to me first and were Quaker, because it was a Quaker publication. And it, you know, some of the things I couldn't use is some people wrote me 2 and 3 pages of just these beautiful descriptions of how they understand themselves, how they respond to negative messaging, how they've claimed themselves. So it was just this incredible gift to get all these responses back from these different people about how they claim and name themselves. And some of those stories were really joyous. Some of them had pain in them. Some of them had humor in them. You know, there's so much in how we experience ourselves in this world. And so it just felt like a really sweet gift to have all these people say, oh, yeah, I'll totally tell you my words, and here you go. And also places where people said, I'll tell you this part, but I'm not going to tell you that part, and wanting to have real respect for what we're willing to make public and what we need to keep private or keep closer.
Yeah. I mean, I you know, I was wondering if there were more than just those 16. It sounds like you had quite a few more than just those 16 come back to you, and that's excellent.
Yeah, I probably had two or three times as many. And some people wrote to me after the deadline. They're like, I really need to sit and think with this. And so it I think it sparked a lot for different people mm-hmm. in the way that whenever we get an invitation to be welcomely honest about who we are, I think there's a lot of energy in that. And so I also hope that by leaving blank spaces on the diagram I put in the article, it would be an invitation for everyone to stop and think and say, oh, yeah, what are the words I want to use? What are the words that best reflect who I am? And a few weeks after I wrote the article, I was staffing the Young Friends Retreat that was on gender relationships and sexuality. And I invited them just to put their words up. And there were just this incredible range and array of words. And we were really focusing kind of on positive ways that we can name ourselves, because so much of the messaging that the young people get is negative. Mm-hmm. And it was just, I mean, it was like a wall of poetry. It was just gorgeous and beautiful. And so I really hope that readers will take that invitation to sit down with somebody else and talk about, yeah, how do I want to name myself? How can I best claim my identity? What are the words that celebrate who I am in this journey that I'm on in this human body?
Yeah, that was, yeah, excellent. So speaking about those diagrams, so there are a couple of diagrams in the issue. I was going to pull those up. Here is one of them.
Yeah.
And then there's another one on that page. And they are just really, you know, well put together. And I was curious as to how those changed over time. You know, mm-hmm. how long have you been using these to kind of give a visual to
yeah.
the way that we talk about?
So the original version of them I learned from Grace Sterling, who's a transgender rights activist and educator in Boston, probably, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago. And then it was sort of an inverted triangle, if you picture a triangle like this, with one point being gender, one point being biological sex, was the term we were using back then, and one point being sexual orientation. I use that a lot just to kind of tease those things out, because a lot of times, particularly when we're talking about people who are queer in any way, gender and sexuality and sexual orientation get conflated, or, you know, we don't separate out, particularly 15 years ago, weren't separating out our physical bodies from gender and looking at assignment versus identity. And so I used that model for a while, and often as I would use it, people would say, wait, that doesn't work for my reality, or what about this, or how about that? And so tried to sort of expand it in response to that, as different people would share different criticisms of it in different ways. And the three interlocking circles is a model we use a lot in Beyond Diversity 101, which is an intensive diversity program that Neona Spann founded that I co-train with her. And I really like the notion of circles, one, because we're Quakers and we do everything in circles, right? We sit in circles, we hold hands, circles, meals. But also that sense of that there's wholeness in each one of those areas, and there's an intersection of those areas. And almost every time I've presented the model, somebody says, wait, romance should be a separate one, or physicality should be a separate one, or what about this? And that's what I like about the model, is that I think it gives enough structure for us to start a conversation, but there's also always the invitation to say, actually, mine looks different. I've got some different circles there, or these are the three that would be primary for me. And so I think it works in providing a simple framework to start a conversation and help people who might be new to some aspects kind of put language and ideas in different places. But literally every time I've shared it with a group of people, somebody says, that doesn't work for me. I want to change it. And, you know, I hope my response is always, yeah, what does yours look like? You know, and again, that's part of what I was trying to get to in the article, is that this is how I understand it, and here's a way that I think we can start to talk about it. But everyone's going to have their own lens and frame that they bring to it.
Yeah. Yeah, that is something that I was thinking about as I was reading through it and looking at it, was, you know, how does this work for me? And also, like, all of the friends that I have, you know, how does it work for them? How might
right.
they, you know, think about this? Is there anyone that's, you know, missing from this diagram that I can think of, which has been really interesting? So
yeah, and that's what I was trying to get to with the two other ones, is that it might look different for other people, mm-hmm. and there's others. So I'm not trying to say this is definitively how we're supposed to be, but here's a place to start the conversation. And really, yeah. the conversation should be about exactly that question of, how do we make sure everybody's included, and how do we make sure we're making space for all these different identities to show up with a level of respect and safety?
Yeah, that's really great. So you wrote this article mm-hmm. as a person who is cis.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that, you do have some forms of privilege.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, privilege is this really great framework that we've has entered public discourse as of recently, and I think it's something that's useful in how we talk about these things. So how did you approach this as someone with some privilege?
Yeah, I appreciate that question a lot. I think it's always an important one to ask, particularly when we're talking about identity and difference. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, first of all, I tried to offer a framework that has grown out of many people responding to it and changing it. So it's not something that I feel like I own or is mine, but is really something that I've tried to make the space for people to say, wait, you need to use this language. And how about that? And what about this? So really trying to present something that I felt sort of been crowdsourced to an extent by a really diverse group of folks. You know, in the article, I talk about myself as an example, not as the example, but a way to try and make some connection with the readers, which is what I do in workshops, but never put my identity as any more or less important than anybody else's, but sort of as one way that this human body and person and spirit has shown up in the world. And I think mostly in trying to make a lot of space for other voices to come forward, which is why I included those profiles. As the second part of the article was that it wasn't just going to be my voice, but it was going to be 17 voices saying, here's our experiences. And at one point in the article, when I talk about how being assigned female, because I am a cisgendered person, identify as female, wasn't traumatic, really wanting to acknowledge that assignment at birth or later in life can be incredibly traumatizing and damaging to people. And so that's where I quoted a transgender friend who had shared some of their experience with me. Like, I wasn't even going to give voice to what that experience was because it's not my experience. But how can I use somebody who gave me permission to use their words to share that experience and make sure that's part of it, so that as we're talking about these things, we acknowledge that things are, that are very easy for me to just kind of mention and say, for somebody else, the lived experience has got so much weight to it that it needs to be held in a different way. And so I tried to lift up those voices and experiences, not in my words, but in people's own words in the article, to make space for that, but then also not claim that I actually even fully know what that experience is, because I don't.
Yeah, that is great. Thank you so much for taking that approach and for talking about it in that way.
And I'd be really curious how people who are watching this video and read the article, you know, if there's other ways that people see my privilege unconsciously showing up in the article, like that's feedback I really want to hear and get to. And I know with one of the other articles already online, people have said, wait, I feel like this is missing, or what about this? And that the author there has really welcomed that feedback. And I really want to say to everybody who's watching this or reading this issue, I really welcome that feedback. And I'm still growing and learning here, and really hope that this can be a place where some more conversation happens about how we can make our Quaker communities more inviting, more affirming, more accepting, and more knowledgeable in how we understand ourselves and each other.
Great. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to add before we finish up?
I haven't had a chance to read the whole issue yet, but just a quick skim, it looked like those of us who are queer in some capacity shared about our experiences in different ways, and that some of the other articles where we don't know the gender or sexual orientation identity of the author necessarily, seems like it may be coming from a perspective of some people who aren't queer writing about interactions with queer people. And what I really hope my article does, and that the issue does, is it invites everybody to think about how do the messages we get about who we are shape who we are? How do we break through the ones of those that are inconsistent with who we are negative or inconsistent with our faith communities? And that topics of gender and sexuality be things that all of us are constantly invited to consider, to learn about, to engage with, and not just kind of a what is often a pretty classic paradigm when talking about diversity of those who have privilege of being seen as the norm, being the ones who learn from the others. Because, you know, to come out in any way, you've got to do a lot. We have to do a lot of internal work. And I think that's internal work that benefits everybody, even if they don't need to come out with a queer identity. So I really hope that people who are cis and who are hetero take this issue as an invitation to think about, wow, what are the places, what are the internal work that I need to do? What are the places that I could look at myself for my own growth and well-being and greater growing into the gifts and purpose that God has for each one of us. And so I hope that's part of the invitation of this issue for everybody.
Well, excellent. I think that is a really nice stopping place for this. Thank you so much for this conversation. It was really wonderful. I think it informs the article in an excellent way. So once again, readers, watchers, and listeners, this was Lisa Graustein talking about her piece, Gender, Sexuality, and Our Bodies. And you can find that in the May 2016 issue, right here, about gender and sexuality. You can also find links to Friends Journal, where you can subscribe, in the video description. Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you. It was really great to talk to you, and I really appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation.